application. It is a private matter, I say. You will have to take my word for that. I do not intend to discuss it, except to say that the magistracy of a district is not a post that can be abandoned like a gatepost. There is a spring in my walk as I marched away to confinement between my two guards. I hope you will allow me to wash, I say, but they ignore me. Never mind. I am aware of the source of my elation. My alliance with the Guardians of the Empire is over. I have set myself in opposition. The bond is broken. I am a free man. Who would not smile? But what a dangerous joy. It should not be so easy to attain salvation. And is there any principle behind my opposition? Have I not simply been provoked into a reaction by the sight of one of the new barbarians usurping my desk and pawing my papers? As for this liberty which I am in the process of throwing away, what value does it have to me? Have I truly enjoyed the unbounded freedom of this past year, in which more than ever before my life has been mine to make up as I go along? For example, my freedom to make of the girl whatever I felt like, wife or concubine or daughter or slave, or all at once or none, at whim, because I had no duty to her, save what it occurred to me to feel from moment to moment. From the oppression of such freedom, who would not welcome the liberation of confinement? In my opposition, there is nothing heroic. Let me not for an instant forget that. It is the same room in the barracks that they used for their interrogations last year. I stand by while the mats and rolls of the soldiers who have been sleeping here are dragged out and piled at the door. My own three men, still filthy and ragged, emerge from the kitchen to stare. "What is that you are eating?" I shout. "Get me some before they lock me up." One of them comes trotting over with his bowl of hot millet gruel. "Take it," he says. The guards motion me to go in. "Just a moment," I say. "Let him fetch my bedroll, then I won't trouble you again." They wait, while I stand in a patch of sunlight, spooning in the gruel like a starving man. The boy with the sore foot stands at my elbow with a bowl of tea, smiling. "Thank you," I say. "Don't be anxious, they won't harm you. You are only doing what you were told." With my bedroll and the old bear fur under my arm, I enter my cell. The soot marks are still on the wall where the brazier used to stand. The door closes and darkness falls. I sleep all day and all night, barely disturbed by the chop-chop of picks behind the wall at my head, or the faraway rumble of barrows and shouts of laborers. In my dreams, I am again in the desert, plodding through endless space towards an obscure goal. I sigh and wet my lips. "What is that noise?" I ask when the guard brings my food. "They are tearing down the houses built against the south wall of the barracks," he tells me. "They are going to extend the barracks and build proper cells." "Ah, yes," I say. "Time for the black flower of civilization to bloom." He does not understand. There is no window, only a hole high on the wall. But after a day or two, my eyes have adjusted to the gloom. I have to shield myself against the light when morning and evening the door is flung open and I am fed. The best hour is early morning, when I wake and lie listening to the first birdsong outside, watching the square of the smoke hole for the instant at which darkness gives way to the first dove-gray light. I am fed the same rations as the common soldiers. Every second day the barracks gate is locked for an hour, and I am let out to wash and exercise. There are always faces pressed against the bars of the gate, gaping at the spectacle of the fall of the once mighty. Many I recognize, but no one greets me. At night, when everything is still, the cockroaches come out to explore. I hear, or perhaps imagine, the horny clicking of their wings, the scurry of their feet across the paved floor. They are lured by the smell of the bucket in the corner, the morsels of food on the floor. No doubt, too, by this mountain of flesh giving off its multifarious odors of life and decay. One night, I'm awoken by the featherlight tread of one crossing my throat. Thereafter, I often jerk awake during the night, twitching, brushing myself off, feeling the phantom probings of their antennae at my lips, my eyes. From such beginnings grow obsessions. I am warned. I stare all day at the empty walls, unable to believe that the imprint of all the pain and degradation they have enclosed will not materialize under an intent enough gaze, or shut my eyes, trying to attune my hearing to that infinitely faint level at which the cries of all who suffered here must still beat from wall to wall. I pray for the day when these walls will be leveled, and the unquiet echoes can finally take wing. Though it is hard to ignore the sound of brick being laid on brick so nearby. I look forward with craving to exercise times, when I can feel the wind on my face and the earth under my soles, see other faces and hear human speech. After 2 days of solitude, my lips feel slack and useless. My own speech seems strange to me. Truly, man was not made to live alone. I build my day unreasonably around the hours when I am fed. I guzzle my food like a dog. A bestial life is turning me into a beast. Nevertheless, it is only on the empty days when I am cast wholly upon myself that I can turn seriously to the evocation of the ghosts trapped between these walls of men and women, who after a visit here no longer felt that they wanted to eat and could not walk unaided. Somewhere, always, a child is being beaten. I think of one who, despite her age, was still a child, who was brought in here and hurt before her father's eyes, who watched him being humiliated before her, and saw that he knew what she saw. Or perhaps by that time she could not see, and had to know by other means. The tone his voice took on when he pleaded with them to stop, for instance. Always I find in myself this moment of shrinking from the details of what went on in here. After that, she had no father. Her father had annihilated himself. He was a dead man. It must have been at this point, when she closed herself off to him, that he threw himself upon his interrogators, if there is any truth in their story, and clawed at them like a wild animal until he was clubbed down. I close my eyes for hours on end, sitting in the middle of the floor in the faint light of day, and try to evoke the image of that man so ill-remembered. All I see is a figure named Father, that could be the figure of any father who knows a child is being beaten whom he cannot protect. To someone he loves, he cannot fulfill his duty. For this, he knows he is never forgiven. This knowledge of fathers, this knowledge of condemnation, is more than he can bear. No wonder he wanted to die. I gave the girl my protection, offering in my equivocal way to be her father. But I came too late, after she had ceased to believe in fathers. I wanted to do what was right. I wanted to make reparation. I will not deny this decent impulse, however mixed with more questionable motives. There must always be a place for penance and reparation. Nevertheless, I should never have allowed the gates of the town to be opened to people who assert that there are higher considerations than those of decency. They exposed her father to her naked and made him gibber with pain. They hurt her, and he could not stop them. on a day I spent occupied with the ledgers in my office. Thereafter, she was no longer fully human, sister to all of us. Certain sympathies died. Certain movements of the heart became no longer possible to her. I, too, if I live long enough in this cell with its ghosts, not only of the father and the daughter, but of the man who even by lamplight did not remove the black discs from his eyes, and the subordinate whose work it was to keep the brazier fed, will be touched with the contagion and turned into a creature that believes in nothing. So I continue to swoop and circle around the irreducible figure of the girl, casting one net of meaning after another over her. She leans on her two sticks, looking dimly upward. What does she see? The protecting wings of a guardian albatross, or the black shape of a coward crow, afraid to strike while its prey yet breathes? Though the guards have orders not to discuss anything with me, it is not difficult to stitch together into a coherent story the snatches of talk I hear on my outings into the yard. All the latest talk is about the fire along the river. 5 days ago it was just a darker smudge against the haze in the northwest. Since then, it has eaten its way slowly down the river course, sometimes dying down, but always reviving, and clearly visible now from the town as a brown shroud over the delta where the river enters the lake. I can guess what has happened. Someone has decided that the riverbanks provide too much cover for the barbarians, that the river would form a more defensible line if the banks were cleared. So they have fired the brush. With the wind blowing from the north, the fire has spread across the whole shallow valley. I have seen wildfires before. The fire races through the reeds. The poplars flare up like torches. Animals that are quick enough, antelope, hare, cat, escape. Swarms of birds fly out in terror. Everything else is consumed. But there are so many barren stretches along the river that fires rarely spread. So it is clear that in this case, a party must be following the fire downriver to see to its progress. They do not care that once the ground is cleared, the wind begins to eat at the soil and the desert advances. Thus, the expeditionary force against the barbarians prepares for its campaign, ravaging the earth, wasting our patrimony. The shelves have been cleared, dusted, and polished. The surface of the desk glows with a deep luster, bare save for a saucer of little glass balls of different colors. The room is spotlessly clean. A vase of hibiscus flowers stands on a table in the corner, filling the air with scent. There is a new carpet on the floor. My office has never looked more attractive. I stand beside my guard in the same clothes I traveled in. My underwear washed once or twice, but my coat still smelling of wood smoke, waiting. I watch the play of sunlight through the almond blossoms outside the window, and am content. After a long while, he enters, tosses a sheaf of papers on the desk, and sits down. He stares at me without speaking. He is trying, though somewhat too theatrically, to make a certain impression on me. The careful reorganization of my office from clutter and dustiness to this vacuous neatness, the slow swagger which he uses to cross the room, the measured insolence with which he examines me, are all meant to say something. Not only that he is now in charge, how could I contest that? But that he knows how to comport himself in an office, knows even how to introduce a note of functional elegance. Why does he think me worth the trouble of this display? Because despite my smelly clothes and my wild beard, I am still from an old family, however contemptibly decayed out here in the back of beyond. Does he fear I will sneer? Unless he armors himself in a decor, picked up, I have no doubt, from careful observation of the offices of his superiors in the Bureau. He will not believe me if I tell him. It does not matter. I must be careful not to smile. He clears his throat. I'm going to read to you from the depositions we have gathered, Magistrate, he says, so that you will have an idea of the gravity of the charges against you. He motions, and the guard leaves the room. From one, his conduct in office left much to be desired. His decisions were characterized by arbitrariness. Petitioners had on occasion to wait months for a hearing, and he maintained no regular system of accounting for monies. He lays down the paper. I may mention that an inspection of your accounts has confirmed that there have been irregularities. Despite being principal administrative officer for the district, he contracted a liaison with a street woman, which occupied most of his energies, to the detriment of his official duties. The liaison had a demoralizing effect on the prestige of imperial administration, because the woman in question had been patronized by the common soldiers and figured in numerous obscene stories. I will not repeat the stories. Let me read to you from another. On the 1st of March, 2 weeks before the arrival of the expeditionary force, he gave orders for myself and two other men, named, to prepare at once for a long journey. He did not at that time say where we were going. We were surprised when we found that the barbarian girl would be traveling with us, but we did not ask questions. We were also surprised by the hastiness of the preparations. We did not see why we could not wait for the spring thaw. It was only after our return that we understood that his purpose had been to warn the barbarians of the coming campaign. We made contact with the barbarians on approximately the 18th of March. He had long consultations with them, from which we were excluded. An exchange of gifts also took place. At this time, we discussed among ourselves what we would do if he ordered us to go over to the barbarians. We decided that we would refuse and find our own way home. The girl returned to her people. He was besotted with her, but she did not care for him. So, he lays the papers down carefully and squares the corners. I keep my silence. I read only extracts, so that you could see the shape of things. It looks bad when we have to come in and clean up local administration. It isn't even our job. I will defend myself in a court of law. Will you? I'm not surprised by what they are doing. I know very well the weight that insinuations and nuances can be made to bear, or how a question can be asked in such a way as to dictate its answer. They will use the law against me as far as it serves them. Then they will turn to other methods. That is the Bureau's way. To people who do not operate under statute, legal process is simply one instrument among many. I speak. No one would dare to say those things to my face. Who is responsible for the first deposition? He waves a hand and settles back. Never mind. You will have your chance to reply. So we contemplate each other in the stillness of the morning, till it is time for him to clap his hands for the guard to remove me. I think about him a great deal in the solitude of my cell, trying to understand his animosity, trying to see myself as he sees me. I think of the care he has spent on my office. He does not simply hurl my papers in a corner and prop his boots on my desk, but instead takes the trouble to display to me his notion of good taste. Why? A man with the waist of a boy and the muscular arms of a street fighter crammed into the lilac-blue uniform that the Bureau has created for itself. Vain, hungry for praise, I am sure. A devourer of women, unsatisfied, unsatisfying. Who has been told that one can reach the top only by climbing a pyramid of bodies. Who dreams that one of these days he will put his foot on my throat and press. And I find it hard to hate him in return. The road to the top must be hard for young men without money, without patronage, with the barest of schooling. Men who might as easily go into lives of crime as into the service of the Empire. But what better branch of service could they choose than the Bureau? Nevertheless, I am not taking easily to the humiliations of imprisonment. Sometimes, sitting on my mat, staring at three specks on the wall, and feeling myself drift for the thousandth time towards the questions, why are they in a row? Who put them there? Do they stand for anything? Or finding as I pace the room that I am counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3. Or brushing my hand mindlessly over my face, I realize how tiny I have allowed them to make my world. How I daily become more like a beast or a simple machine. A child's spinning wheel, for example, with 8 little figures presenting themselves on the rim. Father, lover, horseman, thief. Then I respond with movements of vertiginous terror, in which I rush around the cell, jerking my arms about, pulling my beard, stamping my feet, doing anything to surprise myself, to remind myself of a world beyond that is various and rich. There are other humiliations, too. My requests for clean clothes are ignored. I have nothing to wear but what I brought with me. Each exercise day under the eye of the guard, I wash one item, a shirt or a pair of drawers, with ash and cold water, and take it back to my cell to dry. The shirt I left to dry in the yard was gone 2 days later. In my nostrils there is always the moldy smell of clothing that does not see the sun. And worse, under the monotonous regimen of soup and porridge and tea, it has become an agony for me to move my bowels. I hesitate for days, feeling stiff and bloated, before I can bring myself to squat over the pail and endure the stabs of pain, the tearing of tissues that accompany these evacuations. No one beats me, no one starves me, no one spits on me. How can I regard myself as a victim of persecution when my sufferings are so petty? Yet they are all the more degrading for their pettiness. I remember smiling when the door first closed behind me and the key turned in the lock. It seemed no great infliction to move from the solitariness of everyday existence to the solitude of a cell, when I could bring with me a world of thoughts and memories. But now, I begin to comprehend how rudimentary freedom is. What freedom has been left to me? The freedom to eat or go hungry, to keep my silence or gabble to myself or beat on the door or scream. If I was the object of an injustice, a minor injustice, when they locked me in here, I am now no more than a pile of blood, bone, and meat that is unhappy. My evening meal is brought by the cook's little grandson. I'm sure it puzzles him that the old magistrate has been shut up all alone in a dark room. But he asks no questions. He enters very erect and proud, bearing the tray, while the guard holds the door open. "Thank you," I say. "I'm so glad you have come. I was getting so hungry." I rest my hand on his shoulder, filling the space between us with human words, while he waits gravely for me to taste and approve. "And how is your granny today?"
"She is well, sir,"
And the dog? Has the dog come back yet? From across the yard comes his grandmother's call.
No, sir.
It is spring, you know. It is the mating season. Dogs go visiting. They stay away for days. Then they come back without telling you where they have been. You mustn't be worried. He will come back.
Yes, sir.
I taste the soup as he wants me to do, and smack my lips. Say to your grandmother, thank you for the supper. It is delicious.
Yes, sir.
Again the call. He picks up this morning's mug and plate and prepares to go. And tell me, have the soldiers come back yet? I ask quickly.
No, sir.
I hold the door open and stand for a moment in the doorway, listening to the last twitterings of the birds in the trees, under the great violet sky, while the child crosses the yard with his tray. I have nothing to give him, not even a button. I have not even time to show him how to make his knuckles go click, or how to catch his nose in his fist. I am forgetting the girl. Drifting towards sleep, it comes to me with cold clarity that a whole day has passed in which I have not thought of her. Worse, I cannot remember certainly what she looks like. From her empty eyes there always seemed to be a haze spreading, a blankness that overtook all of her. I stare into the darkness, waiting for an image to form. But the only memory on which I can absolutely rest is of my oiled hands sliding over her knees, her calves, her ankles. I try to recall our few intimacies, but confuse them with memories of all the other warm flesh in which I have sheathed myself in the course of a lifetime. I am forgetting her, and forgetting her, I know deliberately. Not from the moment when I stopped before her at the barracks gate and elected her have I known the root of my need for her. And now I am steadily engaged in burying her in oblivion. Cold hands, cold heart. I remember the proverb, touch my palms to my cheek, sigh in the dark. In the dream there is someone kneeling in the shelter of the wall. The square is quite empty. The wind drives the dust in clouds. She huddles behind the collar of her coat, pulls her cap down to cover her face. I stand over her. Where does it hurt? I say. I feel the words form in my mouth, then hear them emerge, thin, bodiless, like words spoken by someone else. She brings her legs forward awkwardly and touches her ankles. She is so small that she is almost lost in the man's coat she wears. I kneel, unlace the capacious woolen socks, unwrap the bandages. The feet lie before me in the dust, disembodied, monstrous, two stranded fish, two huge potatoes. I lift one onto my lap and begin to chafe it. Tears well from behind her eyelids and run down her cheeks.
It is sore,
she wails in a tiny voice. Shh, I say. I will keep you warm. I lift the other foot and hug the two together. The wind pours dust on us. There is grit on my teeth. I wake up with aching gums and blood in my mouth. The night is still, the moon is dark. I lie for a while looking up into blackness, then slide back into the dream. I enter the barracks gateway and face a yard as endless as the desert. There is no hope of reaching the other side, but I plod on, carrying the girl, the only key I have to the labyrinth, her head nodding against my shoulder, her dead feet drooping on the other side. There are other dreams in which the figure that I call the girl changes shape, sex, size. In one dream, there are two shapes that arouse horror in me. Massive and blank, they grow and grow till they fill all the space in which I sleep. I wake up choked, shouting, my throat full. The texture of the days, on the other hand, is as dull as porridge. Never before has my nose been so rubbed in the quotidian. The flow of events in the outside world, the moral dimension of my plight, if that is what it is, a plight, even the prospect of defending myself in court, have lost all interest under the pressure of appetite and physical functions and the boredom of living 1 hour after another. I have caught a cold. My whole being is preoccupied in sniffing and sneezing, in the misery of being simply a body that feels itself sick and wants to be well. One afternoon, the faint irregular scrape and chink of the bricklayer's trowels on the other side of the wall suddenly ceases. Lying on my mat, I prick my ears. There is a faraway hum in the air, a faint electric quality to the still afternoon that fails to resolve itself into distinguishable sounds, but leaves me tense and restless. A storm? Though I press my ear to the door, I can make out nothing. The barracks yard is empty. Later, the trowels resume their chink-chink. Towards evening, the door opens, and my little friend enters with my supper. I can see that he is bursting to tell me something, but the guard has come in with him and stands with a hand on his shoulder. So only his eyes speak to me. Glowing with excitement, I can swear they say that the soldiers have returned. In which case, why not bugles and cheering? Why not horses trotting across the great square? Why not the noise of preparations for a feast? Why does the guard grip the boy so tightly and whip him away before I can give him a kiss on his shaven skull? The obvious answer is that the soldiers have returned, but not in triumph. If so, I must beware. Later in the evening, there is a burst of noise from the yard and a hubbub of voices. Doors are opened and slammed. Feet tramp back and forth. Some of what is said I can hear clearly. Talk not of strategies or barbarian armies, but of aching feet and exhaustion. An argument about sick men who must have beds. Within an hour, all is quiet again. The yard is empty. Therefore, there are no prisoners. That, at least, is cause for joy. It is mid-morning, and I have had no breakfast. I pace my room, my stomach rumbling like a hungry cow's. At the thought of salty porridge and black tea, my saliva runs. I cannot help it. Nor is there any sign that I will be let out, though this is an exercise day. The bricklayers are at work again. From the yard come sounds of everyday activity. I even hear the cook calling to her grandson. I beat on the door, but no one pays any attention. Then in mid-afternoon, the key scrapes in the lock, and the door opens. "What do you want?" says my warder. "Why have you been banging on the door?" How he must detest me, to spend days of one's life keeping watch on a closed door and attending to the animal needs of another man. He has been robbed of his freedom too, and thinks of me as the robber. "Are you not letting me out today? I haven't had anything to eat." "Is that what you called me for? You'll get your food. Learn some patience. You're too fat anyway." "Wait, I have to empty my bucket. It stinks in here. I want to wash the floor. I want to wash my clothes too. I can't appear in front of the colonel in clothes that smell like this. It will only bring disgrace on my warders. I need hot water and soap and a rag. Let me quickly empty my bucket, and fetch hot water from the kitchen. My guess about the colonel must be right, for he does not contradict me. He opens the door wider and stands aside. "Hurry up," he says. There is only a scullery maid in the kitchen. She gives a start when the two of us walk in. In fact, even seems about to run away. What stories have people been telling about me? "Give him some hot water," the guard orders. She ducks her head and turns to the stove, where there is always a great cauldron of steaming water. Over my shoulder I say to the guard, "A bucket. I will fetch a bucket for the water." In a few strides I am across the kitchen, to the dim recess where, along with sacks of flour and salt and crushed millet and dried peas and beans, the mops and brooms are kept. On a nail at head height is the key to the cellar where the sides of mutton are hung. In an instant, I have pocketed it. When I turn, I have a wooden bucket in my hand. I hold it up while the girl ladles boiling water in. "How are you?" I say. Her hand trembles so much that I have to take the ladle from her. "Can I have a little soap and an old rag, please?" Back in my cell, I strip and wash in the luxuriously warm water. I wash my one spare pair of drawers, which smells like rotten onions, wring it out, hang it on the nail behind the door, and empty the bucket on the paved floor. Then I lie down to wait for nightfall. The key turns smoothly in the lock. How many people besides myself know that the cellar key unlocks the door to my prison room, as well as the large cupboard in the main barracks hall? That the key to the suite of rooms over the kitchen duplicates the key to the armory door? That the key to the northwest tower stairway also opens the northeast tower stairway, the smaller cupboard in the hall, and the hatch over the water pipe in the courtyard? One does not spend 30 years immersed in the minutiae of the life of a tiny settlement for nothing. The stars twinkle out of a clear black sky. Through the bars of the yard gate comes the gleam of a fire on the square beyond. Beside the gate, if I strain my eyes, I can make out a dark shape. A man sitting against the wall or curled up in sleep. Does he see me in the doorway of my cell? For minutes, I stand alert. He does not stir. Then, I begin to edge along the wall, my bare feet making whispering noises on the patches of gravel. I turn the corner and pass the kitchen door. The next door leads to my old apartment upstairs. It is locked. The third and last door stands open. It is the door of the little room sometimes used as a sick bay, sometimes simply to quarter men in. At a crouch, feeling with my hand before me, I creep towards the dim blue square of the barred window, fearful of stumbling over the bodies whose breathing I hear all about me. One strand begins to separate from the skein. The sleeper at my feet breathes fast, at each exhalation giving a little moan. Is he dreaming? I pause, while a few inches from me, like a machine, he continues to pant and moan in the dark. Then I creep past. I stand at the window and look out across the town square, half expecting campfires, lines of tethered horses and stacked arms, rows of tents, but there is almost nothing to see. The embers of a single dying fire, and perhaps the gleam of two white tents far away under the trees. So the expeditionary force is not back. Or is it possible that these few souls here are all that is left of it? My heart stops at the thought. But that is not possible. These men have not been to war. At worst, they have been roaming the upriver country, hunting down unarmed sheep herders, raping their women, pillaging their homes, scattering their flocks. At best, they have met no one at all, certainly not the gathered barbarian clans from whose fury the Third Bureau is engaged in protecting us. Fingers as light as a butterfly's wing touch my ankle. I drop to my knees.
I am thirsty,
confides a voice. It is the man who was panting, so he was not asleep.
Quietly, my son,
I whisper. Staring, I can make out the whites of his upturned eyeballs. I touch his forehead. He is feverish. His hand comes up and grips mine.
I have been so thirsty,
he says.
I will bring you water,
I whisper in his ear.
But then you must promise to be quiet. There are sick men here. They must sleep.
The shadow beside the gate has not moved. Perhaps there is nothing there. Perhaps only an old sack or a stack of firewood. I tiptoe across the gravel to the trough where the soldiers wash. The water is not clean, but I cannot afford to unstop the pipe. A battered pot hangs at the side of the trough. I scoop it full and tiptoe back. The boy tries to sit up, but is too weak. I support him while he drinks.
What happened?
I whisper. One of the other sleepers stirs.
Are you hurt or are you sick?
I am so hot,
he groans. He wants to throw his blanket aside, but I restrain him.
You must sweat the fever out,
I whisper. He shakes his head slowly from side to side. I hold his wrist till he sinks back into sleep. There are three bars set in a wooden frame. All the downstairs windows of the barracks block are barred. I brace my foot against the frame, grip the middle bar, and heave. I sweat and strain. There is a stab of pain in my back, but the bar does not budge. Then all of a sudden, the frame cracks, and I have to cling to prevent myself from falling backwards. The boy begins moaning again. Another sleeper clears his throat. I almost shout with surprise at the pain that comes when I put my weight on my right leg. The window itself is open. Forcing the bars to one side, I push my head and shoulders through the gap, work my way out, and tumble to earth at last, behind the row of cropped bushes that runs along the north wall of the barracks. All I can think of is the pain. All that I desire is to be left to lie in the easiest position I can find, on my side, with my knees raised toward my chin. For an hour, at least, while I could be pursuing my escape, I lie there, hearing through the open window the sighs of the sleepers, the voice of the boy mumbling to himself. The last embers of the fire on the square die. Man and beast are asleep. It is the hour before dawn, the coldest hour. I feel the chill of the earth enter my bones. If I lie here longer, I will freeze and be trundled back to my cell in the morning in a barrow. Like a wounded snail, I begin to creep along the wall towards the dark mouth of the first street leading off the square. The gate to the little area behind the inn lies back, rotten on its hinges. The area itself smells of decay. Peelings, bones, slops, ash are hurled out here from the kitchen to be forked into the ground. But the earth has grown tired. The fork that buries this week's refuse turns up last week's. During the day, the air is alive with flies. At dusk, the black beetle and cockroach wake. Beneath the wooden stairway that leads up to the balcony and servants' quarters is a recess where wood is stored and where the cats retire when it rains. I crawl in and curl up on an old bag. It smells of urine. It is certainly full of fleas. I am so cold that my teeth chatter. But at this moment, all that occupies me is the palliation of the pain in my back. I am woken by a clatter of footsteps on the stairway. It is daylight. Confused, thick-headed, I cower back in my den. Someone opens the kitchen door. From all corners, chickens come scurrying. It is only a matter of time before I am discovered. As boldly as I can, but wincing despite myself, I mount the stairs. How must I look to the world? With my dingy shirt and trousers, my bare feet, my unkempt beard. Like a domestic, I pray, an ostler come home after a night's carousing. The passageway is empty, the door to the girl's room open. The room is neat and tidy as ever, the fleecy skin on the floor beside the bed, the red checkered curtain drawn over the window, the kist pushed against the far wall with a rack of clothes above it. I bury my face in the fragrance of her clothes and think of the little boy who brought my food. Of how, when my hand rested on his shoulder, I would feel the healing power of the touch run through a body grown stiff with unnatural solitude. The bed is made up. When I slip my hand between the sheets, I imagine I can feel the faint afterglow of her warmth. Nothing would please me more than to curl up in her bed, lay my head on her pillow, forget my aches and pains, ignore the hunt that must by now have been launched for me, and like the little girl in the story, tumble into oblivion. How voluptuously I feel the attraction of the soft, the warm, the odorous this morning. With a sigh, I kneel and coax my body in under the bed. Face down, pressed so tightly between the floor and the slats of the bed, that when I move my shoulders, the bed lifts. I try to compose myself for a day in hiding. I doze and wake, drifting from one formless dream to another. By mid-morning, it has become too hot to sleep. As long as I can, I lie sweating in my close, dusty retreat. Then, though I postpone it, the time comes when I have to relieve myself. Groaning, I inch my way out and squat over the chamber pot. Again, the pain, the tearing. I dab myself with a filched white handkerchief, which comes away bloody. The room stinks. Even I, who have been living for weeks with a slop pail in the corner, am disgusted. I open the door and hobble down the passageway. The balcony looks over rows of roofs, then beyond them over the south wall and the desert stretching into the blue distance. There is no one to be seen, except a woman on the other side of the alleyway sweeping her step. A child crawls on hands and knees behind her, pushing something in the dust, I cannot see what. Its neat little bottom points up in the air. As the woman turns her back, I step out of the shadows and hurl the contents of the pot out onto the refuse heap below. She notices nothing. A torpor is already beginning to settle over the town. The morning's work is over. Anticipating the heat of midday, people are retiring to their shaded courtyards or to the cool green of inner rooms. The babble of water in the street furrows dies down and stops. All I can hear is the clink of the farrier's hammer, the cooing of turtle doves, and somewhere, far away, the wail of a baby. Sighing, I lay myself down on the bed in the sweet remembered scent of flowers. How inviting to join the rest of the town in its siesta. These days, these hot spring days, already becoming summer. How easy I find it to slip into their languorous mood. How can I accept that disaster has overtaken my life when the world continues to move so tranquilly through its cycles? It takes no effort to believe that when the shadows begin to lengthen and the first breath of wind stirs the leaves, I will wake up and yawn and dress and descend the stairs and cross the square to my office, nodding to the friends and neighbors I pass, that I will spend an hour or two there, tidy my desk, lock up, that everything will go on being as it has always been. I must actually shake my head and blink my eyes to realize that as I lie here, I am a hunted man. that in the course of their duty, soldiers are going to come here and haul me away and lock me up again out of the sight of the sky and of other human beings. Why? I groan into the pillow. Why me? Never has there been anyone so confused and innocent of the world as I. A veritable baby. Yet if they can, they will shut me away to molder, subject my body to their intermittent vile attentions. Then, one day without warning, fetch me out and rush me through one of the closed trials they conduct under the emergency powers, with the stiff little colonel presiding and his henchmen reading the charges, and two junior officers as assessors to lend the proceedings an air of legality in an otherwise empty courtroom. And then, particularly if they have suffered reverses, particularly if the barbarians have humiliated them, they will find me guilty of treason. Need I doubt that? From the courtroom to the executioner they will drag me, kicking and weeping, bewildered as the day I was born, clinging to the end, to the faith that no harm can come to the guiltless. You are living in a dream, I say to myself. I pronounce the words aloud, stare at them, try to grasp their significance. You must wake up! Deliberately, I bring to mind images of innocence I have known. The boy lying naked in the lamplight with his hands pressed to his groins. The barbarian prisoners squatting in the dust, shading their eyes, waiting for whatever is to come next. Why should it be inconceivable that the behemoth that trampled them will trample me too? I truly believe I am not afraid of death. What I shrink from, I believe, is the shame of dying as stupid and befuddled as I am. There is a flurry of voices, men's and women's, from the yard below. As I scuttle into my hiding place, I hear the tramp of footsteps on the stairs. They recede to the far end of the balcony, then come slowly back, pausing at each door. The wall separating the cubicles on this upper floor, where the servants sleep, and where a soldier of the garrison can buy a night's privacy, are mere slats papered over. I can hear clearly, as my hunter throws open each door in turn. I press myself against the wall. I hope he does not smell me. The footsteps round the corner and come down the passage. My door is opened, held open for a few seconds, closed again. So I have passed one test. There is a quicker, lighter tread. Someone runs down the passage and enters the room. My head is turned the wrong way. I cannot even see her feet, but I know it is the girl. This is the moment at which I ought to come into the open, beg her to hide me till night falls, and I can find my way out of the town and down to the lakeside. But how can I do it? By the time the bed has stopped heaving and I have emerged, she will have fled screaming for help. And who is to say that she would offer refuge to one of the many men who have spent time in this room, one of many passing men, from whom she earns a livelihood, a man in disgrace, a fugitive? Would she even recognize me as I am? Her feet flutter about the room, stopping here, stopping there. I can make out no pattern in their movements. I lie still, breathing softly, sweat dripping off me. All at once, she is gone. The stairs creak. There is silence. A lull falls over me, too. A spell of lucidity, in which I see how ridiculous it is, all this running and hiding. What a silly thing it is to be lying under a bed on a hot afternoon, waiting for a chance to sneak away to the reed breaks, there to live, no doubt, on birds' eggs and fish that I can catch with my hands. Sleeping in a hole in the earth, biding my time till this phase of history grinds past, and the frontier returns to its old somnolence. The truth is that I am not myself. I have been terror-stricken, I perceive, since the moment in my cell when I saw the guard's fingers clamp over the shoulder of the little boy to remind him not to speak to me, and knew that whatever it was that had happened that day, I was to bear the blame for it. I walked into that cell a sane man, sure of the rightness of my cause, however incompetent I continue to find myself to describe what that cause may be. But after 2 months, among the cockroaches, with nothing to see but four walls and an enigmatic soot mark, nothing to smell but the stench of my own body, no one to talk to but a ghost in a dream whose lips seem to be sealed, I am much less sure of myself. The craving to touch and be touched by another human body sometimes comes over me with such force that I groan. How I looked forward to the single brief contact, which was all I could have with the boy morning and evening. To lie in a woman's arms in a proper bed. To have good food to eat. To walk in the sun. How much more important these seem than the right to decide without advice from the police who should be my friends and who my enemies. How can I be in the right when there is not a soul in the town who approves of my escapade with the barbarian girl, or who would not feel bitter against me if young men from here were killed by my barbarian protégés? And what is the point of suffering at the hands of the men in blue if I am not iron-hard in my certainty? No matter if I told my interrogators the truth, recounted every word I uttered on my visit to the barbarians, no matter even if they were tempted to believe me, they would press on with their grim business. For it is an article of faith with them that the last truth is told only in the last extremity. I am running away from pain and death. I have no plan of escape. Hiding away in the reeds, I would starve within a week, or be smoked out. I am simply seeking ease, if the truth be told, fleeing to the only soft bed and friendly arms I have left to me. Again, footsteps. I recognize the girl's quick tread, this time not alone, but with a man. They enter the room. By his voice, he cannot be more than a boy.
You shouldn't let them treat you like that. You're not their slave, he says with vehemence. You don't understand, she replies. Anyway, I don't want to talk about it now.
There is silence, then more intimate sounds. I flush. It is intolerable that I should stay for this. Yet like the cuckold in the farce, I hold my breath, sinking further and further into disgrace.